Okay, this is interviewing John Baldwin at Kroningen on 26 July 1972. Well, now you're an old hand at Cambridge, and I guess Ryle is still older, though. Is that correct?
Yes, he started research there immediately after the war in 46.
I see. Was he working on radar during the war?
Yes, and so in fact he'd been indirectly connected with a person who was the head of the radio group in Cambridge then, who was Ratcliffe, who had also been working on radar. I think he'd been just about to come to Cambridge just before the war started, probably as a research student, but that had gone to work on radar or various aspects of.
Was there a wartime lab sort of thing at Cambridge?
No, not in Cambridge. No. No, it was in various places and ended up in Malvern. And so he returned to a group that was really an ionosphere group, a group that had really been built up by Appleton. And he started doing radio astronomy, therefore, by himself, and as a student of Ratcliffe's.
I see. What was the impetus for radio astronomy?
Well, it had arisen. Really, people knew almost nothing about Jansky's work. But it had arisen during the war, partly because of, I think, the solar interference studies in radar.
Hayes.
Yes. Yes, in fact, Hayes' work was the impetus for it, rather than. I don't think they knew the work of Southworth at all.
I see.
That was. I mean, it was available in principle, but. Not known.
Nor Reber's, because Reber had a couple of papers around 1940.
Yeah. That, again, I would think was not known at all.
So, neither of them had been amateur astronomers, or it was just something to do once the war effort was.
That's right. They were keen to get back into research, and it was the techniques that had been developed during the war, which hadn't been possible, which made a whole new field open for investigation.
Right.
And in a sense, it was an extension of some of the ionosphere work, you see, which had been pulse sounding work. Then, quite shortly after that, there was Hayes' discovery of the variations in the source and Cygnus, which then turned out to be ionospheric.
Right.
And so that again tied in all this business of irregularities and so on.
So what did Ryle do?
Well, he, and I suppose it was Stanier in the first place, and shortly afterwards, I suppose, Machin, who were trying to make a... Oh, sorry, no, it was Ryle and von Berg to start with, and then there was Stanier and Machin a bit later. And they set out to make a receiver. And I think they spent quite a long time making it, because they decided that to do anything sensible, you had to make a receiver which was very much more stable than existing ones.
Mm-hmm.
There was some amount of argument with Ratcliffe over this.
What frequency was it?
And this would be, I suppose, either 80, about 80 megahertz, or about 170, something like that.
Okay.
Those two frequencies were both made, worked on a fairly early date. And this was therefore a feedback receiver, and did prove for total power measurements to be very stable, and this is what they used in all their early observations.
But now, a question just occurs to me. The war had a great development in microwave radar and so forth, but this isn't directly applicable to 80 megahertz work. Or I suppose components, low noise components and so forth, were all developed.
Yes, now, why it was specifically at the lower frequencies, I'm not sure, except that... all the early radar work, of course, in England was at lower frequencies.
How?
I mean, it started off, the stuff in 1938 and so on was around something like 300 megahertz.
Oh, I see. I didn't realize that was done that well.
And it was only quite later on with the invention of the magnetron that centimeter wave radar really became a...
Okay, well that's just a misconception.
Yeah, it was just a matter of time. And so that I think they'd had quite a lot of experience in the lower frequencies. They knew that as far as the engineering was concerned, it was...
So they were developed more, really?
Yes, and of course they'd been involved in a lot of telecommunication things with aircraft, which were VHF frequencies.
That's right.
Not so much from the point of view of communication, but from the point of view of interception and confusing of, navigation systems and this kind of thing.
Right.
So I think they probably had a lot of experience at the lower frequencies.
Okay. Well, I detracted you. So you were talking about building these.
And all the early work, therefore, was directed towards the sun, because that's the thing that's been seen. It had the advantage that it's quite a bright source, at least when it's variable, and furthermore, it changes from day to day, so there's something else to look at. And the original telescopes were extremely simple. I think the original ones were probably built in his back garden. So he has a house just on the...
I see, in Ryle's.
Ryle's
back garden. In the Reber tradition.
Well, yes, now his house is just on the west of Cambridge. Out at the back of his house was the ionospheric field station with a few aerials and huts there. But I think for some reason one or two of the original radio astronomy instruments were built in his garden.
He still lives in the same house?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
In Herschel Road, as it turns out.
Now, what were these first arrays?
They would be extremely simple dipole arrays. I'm not quite sure whether I ever saw the first ones that were built. I suspect I did, but I couldn't swear to that. And they would be at most about two full-wave dipoles. And even at that stage, although it was a total power system, they were using interferometers, total power interferometers, just so that you could actually separate the sun from the galactic background.
Oh, yeah.
So that...
They must have become aware, then, of Reber's work, if they knew about the galactic background and so forth.
I suppose after a little while, they did hear about this.
Yeah.
But I don't think it influenced what they did.
That ends this side of the tape.